I'm Duncan MacLeod, and this is TCS Plus, the business technology show brought to you by Tech Central. You can subscribe to us on YouTube at youtube.com/TechCentral or wherever you get good podcasts. Now, I'm pleased to welcome Cyber One Solutions back to the show today for what I'm sure is going to be a fascinating discussion on data and identity governance. And to have this discussion, I'm joined in the studio by Cyber One Solutions Senior Cybersecurity Architect, Christian Swanepoel. And Christian is joined today by Jason O'Reilly, who is MD of Cyber One Solutions. Welcome to you both, and thanks for your time.
Yeah, thanks, Duncan.
Let's start with the definitions. Maybe I should start with you, Jason. What is data and identity governance, and why is it important?
Well, I think, you know, when we start looking at how organizations view their data, and most importantly, when they start to add all of the relevant controls, all of the mandates that are required by either regulation or by their own organization around policies, there's got to be a very clear view as to what is the right data that they do that to. We get stuck in conversations all the time about, you know, where data lives, structured, unstructured, you know, users, who constitutes a user, what data do they use? And I think the challenge comes in, I mean, even development nowadays, we're seeing even what data is the API. I mean, the conversation around data and data governance is a huge challenge. And organizations understanding how do they manage that has become such an overarching aspect before you start putting in controls and you start managing it. And I think when we start understanding that, really it's the organization understanding what it does, how it's consumed, and who manages it, it really brings to the fold as to, you know, what do they actually start doing with that data when they go on. And It's so important that it fulfills part of those requirements. The requirements are becoming stringent, more stringent. We're seeing so many more people popping into the news nowadays, so much more data being stolen. Again, I mean, this week alone has been great, and we're only in Tuesday. But if we don't look at how we're managing our data and get a true understanding of the organization's value, who has access to it, you know, how's it managed, how's it flow, what do you do as an organization to protect something you don't understand?
We've been talking about this stuff, though, for a very long time, haven't we, Christian? I mean, I remember having conversations with IT experts, with CIOs, going back 10 years or more on this particular topic. Why are we still having the conversation in 2024? Is it because it is such a difficult thing to solve?
I think the easy answer to that is, you know, 10 years back, 20 years back, CISOs, architects, they were saying, right, in the next 5 years, we're going to solve our identity issues, we're going to solve our data governance issues. And unfortunately, nothing has changed. The bar is constantly being moving on. And I think that it comes back to the risk aspects, you know. Historically, organizations were targeted as organizations.
Yeah.
At the moment, and I mean, just this week in news as well, massive articles around consumers. The target at the moment is consumers, you as the identity. And what that entails, previously from a risk perspective, you looked at it and said, right, let's protect the data and the information. But at the moment, what are the threat actors after? Okay, they're after your credential set to either use it in your personal capacity as a consumer, be it on a banking platform or be it in a, you know, wherever your intellectual property or papaya data sits, or it's utilized to access corporate data that you have access to. So inside the actual credential, with the credential inside the actual organization. And the problem comes from a security perspective is that all of that access looks normalized. If you look at the log and you look at the actual access to that information, it looks normalized in those target systems. It doesn't look like a breach attempt, someone trying to DDoS and brute force a password or brute force an actual attack vector or CVE that's known. These are normalized connections. And they're being utilized more and more from a fraud perspective as well, internal and consumer. I think the context is identity is still a very relevant topic because it's being utilized more and more so, and it adversely affects all of the risk in the organization.
Is it because more and more companies are collecting more and more data about individuals that this has become such a big problem?
I think not necessarily only that. More so that in the modern society that we live in, how we interact as consumers, how we expect to interact as staff members inside organization, we've become very normalized to ease of access and yes. ease of authentication and ease of accessibility of services and function. And unfortunately, as that ease and that normalization goes out, it goes to the entire populace, right? So our general adoption of technology has increased drastically in the past 5 years. And that obviously, the more attack points, or you know, the more people there are, the more attack points there's going to be for each of those organizations and each of those consuming aspects.
And I think also the other aspect is, if we look at the threat actor is effectively looking at the easiest way. Obviously, return on investment is, you know, social engineering is still huge. Mm-hmm. We've seen data growing at 250 to 300%. So more apps are being used, more consumption. I mean, we've created data lakes and data oceans and all kinds of really crazy acronyms because of the consumption of data. You know, some of the customers that we're sitting with, you know, even into the traditional way that we do cybersecurity and just simple things like data loss prevention, you know, we've got reams and reams and reams of data, but contextualizing it then relies data analysts or, you know, business intelligence tools or, and I mean, again, it's going to continue this way until we actually say enough is enough. And, you know, let's start figuring out how do we classify its source. Most importantly, start making sure we're consuming the right data and not just logs that are there for the sake of being there, because no disrespect intended to Microsoft, but, you know, almost 90% of Microsoft logs are useless. Mm-hmm. It's the, you know, it's the percentage that you need. And again, coming back to the governance, you know, what are you actually looking for? And this is what our threat actors are, you know, our insider risk conversations happening now. The conversations really changed from somebody trying to brute force the organization to going, hold on, we figured out you haven't got this. Mm-hmm. Actually, it's easier coming in through the front door through somebody that's going to, and again, we'll talk about that link that we hate so much, that little blue item or purple item on your phone. Let's get in slowly. Let's lay around, because you've got so much going on. We can take advantage of you for years before you know. And then finally, when we decide to leave, you go, oh, hold on, somebody's here. And that's, you know, again, coming back to, you've got to understand what's happening in your organization. It's one of the things and the foundations of, you know, just simple information security is you've got to have visibility, you know.
Mm-hmm. Does the friction around doing the stuff and getting it right cause a lot of companies, do you think, not to want to do it? Because I mean, I imagine in protecting this data, you need to put up quite a lot of barriers that could actually make it more difficult to do business.
Well, and you know, we mentioned concept now, but the way that we used to do things 4 years ago is not the way that we do things today.
Mm-hmm. How has that changed?
Well, it's because, you know, now we, what's happened is one, technology has changed, but our mindset hasn't. Our mindset is still, we need to classify everything.
Mm-hmm.
Our mindset, whereas if you think about it, the mindset today is, let's understand what baseline is. You know, let's understand what regular behavior, what regular data looks like in our business. And then let's just go and look at the anomaly, right? But a lot of people are still very much, and it is people, unfortunately, are still in that age-old, well, let's figure out how we classify all of this. We're going to spend our time on a classification program and also a discovery program for the next 10 years of our lives, knowing that we've got somebody sitting in, you know, Azerfontein, who's creating their own data lake because they're developing. And you just can't do that. Mm-hmm. And I think the reality is those data points are becoming more and more and more. And your average user is creating more data than they ever have before because of all the apps, right?
Yeah,
I think another key point there is isolation in IT. IT is a massive industry, right? And inside organizations dealing with IT problems, they have historically pillared specific sections of the organization and IT into subsections. What we're seeing is specific use cases around data sits inside a data team. Mm. You know, they've got the data scientists, analysts, etc. on that team. And then you've got security and perimeter and identity sitting in a completely different pillar. So something that we see in the market today is utilization of, Gartner calls it the mesh architecture. And it's around solving a problem where organizations are trying to solve business challenges, but in isolation. You know, these separate pillars are actually trying to solve similar use cases in isolation. So that's where you get the disparity between data an identity, and where you still have today separate teams that look towards use cases that touch upon each other very similarly. Rightfully so, on the identity side, it's about context and what information and access and service. But on the data side, it's the actual intellectual property, but also the context of what identities are actually accessing the information. So, you know, recent years have now kind of said, right, guys, you can't work in isolation. This needs to come together at a single point. And that's where we are today, is kind of having those conversations about, right, how do we merge these use cases and solve for the same problem as an organization and reduce that global risk?
And Duncan, one of the key things that I've noticed is we started on a journey 7 years ago, even prior to this organization, talking to customers about things like CASB, right? Something as simple as, you know, unsanctioned applications. Mm. Believe it or not, 7 years ago, today, we're only starting to adopt it. So, you know, we've got a really clear view that, you know, South African customers, we're not early adopters. There are a couple of clients that are early adopters, but generally, we're 7 years behind our European counterparts and obviously our US counterparts. Now, if I'm looking at that from a threat actor's perspective, that's awesome, right? Now I can actually go into, and we're starting to see now the proliferation of that challenge hitting our organizations quite hard.
And I think that the article was also released this week around South Africa in comparison to, you know, European and US countries, and the amount of targeting actually taking place and the year-by-year increases. We're in the three digits, the 110 percentile of yearly increases focused around our consumers, around our identities. And it is because our policies and our legislation are lacking in terms of quicker adoption, etc. But it's taking some time. And you know, it's the same with organizations, the same with the papaya conversation. You know, the moment that we actually see a director being accused and possibly taken to jail or jail terms or fines, and organizations fined for you know, infringing on the papaya act, you know, all of those organizations are still taking it in a bit in the back stride. You know, it's not a key focus for them to solve because there's no ramifications of if they don't solve for.
Well, the first marketing company got served last week, right?
Oh, yeah.
You spoke about the different teams in organizations and how they don't always talk to each other. In larger, I know this isn't always possible in small and medium enterprises, but in larger organizations, is there a case to be made that perhaps there should be a new senior role created in the organization specifically responsible for looking after data?
Well, you talk about that. There are. What's quite interesting is, I mean, having worked with some of our larger organizations, there definitely is. There's a CDO, Chief Digital and or Data Officer.
Yep.
But they don't seem to last long.
Why is that?
Well, data's growing 300%, right? His salary's not increasing 300%. So no, I think it becomes a capacity challenge, right. And it also becomes, also I think, you know what, and we spoke about doing the things, you know, effectively, you know, 3 years ago versus where we are today. I mean, some of the conversations we're having in our space is, you know, we're getting to understand data better, right? We're sort of, you know, a lot of the technology vendors are bringing together these packs that you can buy and again, or you're part of your suite of solutions and you can actually start segregating your data correctly. But I think, you know, to try and do that in a siloed effect is kind of tough. Mm. You know, even us as, you know, systems integrators into customers' environments and trying to figure out, because we're still at the same space, right? You know, some of our customers are trying to save hundreds of millions of rands, but you know, but they've still got to secure themselves better, and they've got to, you know, they've got to try and get the organization to effectively invest more because of the consumer, right? You know, the end point at the end of the day is consumer experience, internal operational excellence, all the things that we know. But that it's a struggle because there are so many moving parts. There's always a case to be made for, but that's somebody who, in my experience working with a CDO, it's primarily, you're looking at cost, you're looking at efficiencies, and you're looking at duplication from a data perspective. And again, not fully understanding their mandates, you know, those are some of the questions that we help answer, but it's not easy. You know, we sell to a select bunch of people, and those people don't always have data in mind. In fact, if you walk over to your cybersecurity pillar, they want as much data as they can get, right? Because the more data they have, the more they can sift and they can hunt and they can find the actor. yet the business can't consume that amount of data because we should be serving up the right data, right?
Well, I was just about to ask. Yeah. It's very easy in IT. It's the business model of some IT companies like Google to collect as much data as possible and to analyze that data for profit. Are we collecting too much data? Is that part of the problem?
Yes. I mean, we've got great examples of working with customers where when we have the use cases, we can cut their data down and even their licensing spend, their operational efficiency spend by almost down by 70%. Because what you're doing is you're getting rid of the ones and the zeros that aren't important and you're actually focusing. But that takes effort. That takes time. In one or two of the projects, it's taken us 6 months to save the customer, 10 million rand a month. That was a big customer, by the way. But once you get that done, you can sit back and go, geez, where could you ever do that by consolidating vendors, cutting off partners, reducing full-time heads. Sure. It's a different conversation, right?
It's part of the governance conversation. Is the volume of data that your company is sitting on, should that be part of the conversation and deciding, well, actually, we don't need to collect that information?
I think separating two separate conversations, collecting of information and then utilization of information, right? And a simple example here, as our modern society and phone cameras have increased, obviously our size of photos actually taken has also increased. And as that data, that we generated from a consumer perspective has increased, photo size has increased. You send that photo off to a banking channel, they capture it, they save it. Mm-hmm. You've scanned the data will grow either way. Consumption of the information will grow. We know that data storage costs are on the drastic increase. That's the most expensive thing that you can consume on if you look at SaaS services or web services. So your spend is going to increase. Where you store the information, how you manage it, how can you identify what information should be stored, that's valuable and that's key. But that information will grow either way.
Yeah.
Okay? The growth will be there. It's about, if you bring in the compliance and the governance aspects, it's around protection of the information. It's about data leakage. It's about preventing that the organization faces a liability when information is leaked. Okay, one of the biggest things in IT is it's not if you will be hacked, it's when. Mm-hmm. Right? The guarantee is at some point and metric, there are threat actors inside your organization, possibly already, and they are after the intellectual property and the data sets, be that from a consumer or be that from an organizational base. We see a rise at the moment, the consumers being targeted, but we have to remember that those threat actors going after intellectual property and data exfiltration are also still there. With the rise in our market, and maybe this is also a starting point for us from an AI perspective, is our threat actors have grown more increasingly abundant. And the reason is because coding has become such a normalized thing. Mm-hmm. Utilization of generative AI tooling to utilize generative AI to create the code that you actually need to breach a specific CVE or a specific vulnerability has become such normalized that high school kids can actually become very adequate hackers. Mm-hmm. So how do you protect against your risk and your threat vectors that have just exploded? And one of the concepts is a perimeter for an organization, as we know, has drastically changed in the last 5 years. Perimeter was something that you could control, you could see, it was a firewall, it was a physical office building. 5 years later, it's everywhere.
And COVID helped dismantle those barriers.
COVID helped completely break down every single barrier that security teams have been putting in place for the last 20 years in a matter of minutes and months. Mm-hmm. And the context that we have today is that the perimeter is everywhere. So how do you protect against everything if it's everywhere? And that's where the identity becomes. If you protect at the identity layer, mm-hmm. you actually have the most chance of actually protecting the organization.
And what does that practically mean doing?
Well, look, it's about having your standards and your procedures in place with regards to how you authenticate, but also around how you actually access information. A long-standing terminology in the industry is zero trust.
Yes.
And how to utilize zero trust, and every single vendor takes it as a rubber stamp and, you know, stamps it on their products. It's the same what we see with CASB, the same. You know, a lot of those hype words are being thrown at solutions that don't look towards solving the problem.
Right.
And if we take a step back and, you know, look towards zero trust as an argument, it should be around providing access as required when needed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, it should be about minimizing your possible risk. Now, that sentence applies to the identity and there's access to systems and services, but also the data context. You know, what information sets. And it's all coming, you know, quite handsomely together that identity is the center of where we protect, but it's also the center of what's being attacked.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a case to be made when we often sit down with customers, and I spoke to you about the last 3-4 years, even further back, 7 years back, where the data protection conversation would come in. If an organization employs somebody at a certain level in an organization, at that point in time, that user's being classified, right? Whatever information they create, whatever information they have access to, that's all done through something as simple as Active Directory, and all their rights are created. Mm. So from a governance and an HR perspective, they work with IT. IT say, okay, this is what you're allowed to do. At that point, we should be baselining.
Mm-hmm.
And believe it or not, that's where classification has moved to. That's where data protection has moved to. That's where insider threat has moved to. Is once we understand what Jason's regular behavior is, well, anything that deviates from that, that's all that we should be looking for, right? And believe it or not, it's trying to get that concept across is proving to be quite the challenge, because we're still used to having a data classification engine, or, you know, structured or unstructured. We're so used to doing things, and governance in itself has become the challenge, is because it's easier to tick the box and fill out the paperwork as opposed to saying, hold on, let's just scrump this up and let's go, okay, Jason's joining the organization. What's he going to create? What does he need access to? And anything outside of that, let's monitor.
Mm-hmm.
Because at that point in time, and we've seen that through the breaches we've seen, through manipulation of data or, you know, insider threat activity, Jason did something different. Now, that's what we spend our lives doing, right? And also, what data is he creating? Those are the things that, you know, we should get ourselves to a point of saying, at that point, when an employee joins, or a system is activated,
create the rules then.
That's it. And that's where the governance plays such a huge part. However, what happens is a system is switched on and, you know, a week later somebody comes in and they start creating the policies because, yeah, you know, I'm not the policy guy. I'm the put it in the rack guy. And eventually the system gets up and running, or eventually, SharePoint gets shared. But that time has already saved 1,000 documents on his desktop.
Yes.
And nobody's monitoring that.
I was going to ask, how do you deal with the concept of shadow IT as well? Because companies, especially since COVID, people just bring whatever they want into the office or use it remotely.
Well, maybe as a good example, yeah. is one of our customers, in the same context of, you know, pre-COVID to post-COVID and that enablement process of going from a fully on-premise, maintain your entire infrastructure to adopting Azure and rolling out to all the users in a quick, short amount of time. 50,000 odd users sitting with an Active Directory count of 85,000. And they started to notice, but hold on, these are 85,000 active accounts, but we only employ 45,000. Plus minus 5,000 extra odd contractors, but we still have a massive disparity. This is not a minor disparity, it's a massive disparity. So they noticed that as part of their quick to change adoption process, when they started enabling services, they enabled SharePoint teams and Teams to be activated by the actual team owners.
Mm-hmm.
So they could invite external people into their actual structure where they were storing their data, and how they were communicating with their third parties, with their contractors, with their internal staff, and all of external people. Some of them And possibly most of them rightfully so. You know, it's a contractor, it's a service provider that's now sharing around information, and the business is prospering due to that share of information. But there's been no governance actually applied to the creation and the access layer.
That user, yeah.
Because the shadow IT, that user that's sitting there creating a team, understanding what his job, role, and position is, but now he has an easier way of doing it. And the problem that we face today is we can't just switch off these accounts. Yes, they're there. They're being, you know, very costly, but they're actually being utilized from a business perspective. But how do you then suddenly apply security policies after the fact and governance policies after
the fact? Well, that's where the business kicks back, right?
Yes.
And you potentially could break things. And,
Well, you could stop the business process, right?
Yeah, exactly.
When we talk about when we talk about typical IT security and, you know, a secretary that gets hacked and ransomware on her laptop, and I know for her it's the worst case in the world, but does the organization actually stop? Does the organization stop functioning? No. So you don't want to impact that business process. The same goes, you know, when we talk about, and a lot of our other customers from an OT and an IoT perspective, And these, you know, in our normalized Purdue levels and all of the machining and manufacturing industries, a lot of those technology sets are becoming smart. They're becoming alive. They're reading contextual information from supply chain, reading contextual information from retail, however that may be. What we're also noticing is that those actual identities, which would be the IoT devices, are also vastly at risk here. They're trying to communicate. They don't have the facility, and the identity is actually not being considered as part of that authentication or as part of that access. So we're seeing that heavily expanded on.
What about encryption and the role of encryption? How important is that, and are companies making use of it enough?
Yeah, look, I think encryption comes, you know, obviously in two fashions, you know, encryption of data at rest and encryption of data in transit. You know, data in transit typically to try and prevent that anyone can actually access that data. Data at rest, be it from a retention system or an archiving system, that you need to encrypt that data so that no one can access to it. I think the more modern approach to that is to encrypt the data and encrypt specific parts of the information. So, you know, there's tooling and services available that can actually, as part of your scanning and classification and, you know, your governance model of the data, identify that privileged information, be it PCI data or PAPI or GDPR data or whatever metrics you as a business actually deem as sensitive, and then actually classify the items inside the files. So not just classifying the file itself, but actually classifying and redacting the privileged information.
Okay.
I mean, there's always two frames of thought, right? There's those that ideally say, listen, let's just crypt everything, but you realize you will break the business. So what we typically have, and especially in, like, again, financials, the PCI data, that's encrypted, right? And there's nothing wrong with the encrypted because they're credit card numbers.
Sure.
I think it's the privileged access. It's the ones that effectively have the decryption key ultimately at the end of the day, or the keys to the kingdom. You know, the minute that becomes in clear text, you know, how do you then deal with that? And I think that's where that in transit and at rest conversation is critical. But that is becoming a more pertinent conversation at the moment, primarily because of how many more attempts we're seeing, how many more ransomware attacks and how many more social engineering attacks we're seeing, and more organizations in the news, right?
Yeah, listen,
and this is maturity, you know, but the reality is I think we're taking too long to learn. You know, when I say 7 years, people will laugh at me and they'll say, you know what, I walked into a customer pretty recently, and when CASB came out, we were one of the first to market talking to people about CASB, and we went to most of organizations out there, and they're like, no, Microsoft is coming next year. We went, that's fine, but you've got a whole bunch of shadow IT. And no, we know, but, you know, we'll get there. And then obviously there were breaches and things happened. And 7 years later, we're going, geez, like, you know what, this CASB, I think it's the next hot thing. And I'm like, but we've moved on, right? So again, let's get back to access. Let's get back to, you know, we appreciate CASB. We appreciate all the moving parts. I think the challenge is, you know, working with our organizations at the moment, you spoke about zero trust. We talk about the NIST models. There's all these really clear methodologies, right? And you can't go and tick all of the boxes. You have to understand your business.
You have to understand your business's data flows. You need to understand your user community. Because only if you do that, and I think it is one of the things, I went on a journey when I worked for Symantec, which was purely around governance. Because the one thing we found was it was easy for IT to throw a tech at the problem. And we said, well, hold on, let's build a governance strategy around, let's understand your risk. Once we understand your risk all the way down to the user level, then we can apply the right controls at the right time with the right identity access, right? And that was a journey that I spent 18 months looking at and working with a lot of customers, and we were making progress. But people still went mad because technology. And the reality is if you go to the RSA conferences now, it's, you know, there are 7,000 vendors there. But we're still only trying to solve for the MITRE attack framework, right? So that little attack framework, it's a known methodology. Zero Trust is a known methodology. NIST is a known way of managing the standard. But we're still ignoring that when the auditor walks in the room and goes, you've got that problem, buddy. Mm-hmm. Everybody goes, well, maybe I should look at my processes and make sure I can people, process, and then technology. Nope.
Do companies spend too much time listening to the vendors? Because, I mean, the vendors are always punting particular point solutions.
Love what you're asking. Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, we found ourselves, especially in 2023, at the core of the desperation in the vendor community. I cannot tell you the amount of desperate vendors were out there to do deals. Mm-hmm. Not the right thing for the client. And in fact, I've been in one or two shouting matches with vendors where it's about doing the deal, not the right thing for the customer. It's about, somebody mentioned this to me the other day, platformerization. I'm like, that's not a word, you know? You know, back in the day when I worked for, you know, for McAfee, you know, we had the best of suite. That rolls off the tongue easier, right? But now we're platformerizationing, because the problem we're having is all these vendors are acquiring more and more technologies. Mm. The problem is they're not buying the best of the best. So this is where we found ourselves, is when we're trying to address a specific use case for the client, let's, as systems integrators, have a look at the best technology for the customer. I appreciate you've got Microsoft and you've got Cisco and you've got the two-ton Tessies there, but they're not going to address it in the best possible way that will help. But that also introduces, and that's for me where I think this concept of the mesh architecture really starts to change the conversation with the client.
What do you mean by that?
Well, so where you have the ability, because we know customers have already made investments. You're utilizing all these tools that you've already got, whether ITSM tools, whether cyber tools, whether, you know, analytical tools. You need the ability just to use the telemetry, right? Mm-hmm. So where the mesh architecture concept really comes from, and I see it's not quite anywhere near the trough of disillusionment on the Gartner hype cycle, but it's on the base where we're now starting to say, well, you've invested in key areas that your business requires. All we need is the telemetry to be able to make better decisions. I don't need all the telemetry. I need bits and pieces. So you've invested in CASB or you've invested in AI or BI tools, not a problem. We need the bits and pieces from that to be able to make better decisions. And in cyber, that's a great place to be. But I think in any part of the business, when you look at the amount of data that's available, if you have the ability to only pull out the right data to be able to make the right decision, and this is where AI in cybersecurity plays a really, really strong part, is I have the ability at that point in time, and we mentioned it earlier, if it walks like a duck, quacks like a dog, you know, then it's not something we should pay attention to. But if it walks, quacks, and swims like a duck, then that's the only time the business should really sit up and pay attention. And I think the conversation then comes down is, you don't need 1,000 analysts, you need 5. Mm-hmm. You know, you can outsource certain aspects because you only have this amount of telemetry that needs to be. So I think that we'll see that change over the next coming years, because there is just too much technology. Vendors are driving it. Mm-hmm. We know that. They are marketing engines. We feel the pressure every day. You know, I'll give you an idea. We've got 4 firewall vendors in our stable, right? Oh, I get beaten up every day. You know, if I do a post on this one, oh, I have the other one. Why are you talking about them? And the reality is as systems integrators, you know, we've got to sit with the customer. We've got to look at their business. Yeah. We've got to understand their user community, their customers, their data, and then help them make the right decision. By the way, cost is such a big one because it's not infinity. Mm. And the reality is every meeting, I mean, first meeting we walked into January this year, I've got to cut my cost by 25%. How can you help?
Yeah.
You know, I heard none of the vendors go, oh, no worry, we'll cut our price by 20%. You're okay. So, no, it's very, very interesting. And I think the reality is also, if I look at the customer community, you know, there is such a difference between maturity of resources that are in these clients that have that capability to be advising. Mm. Because, again, one of the things I often teach my daughter this is, you know, they are sheeple. You know, effectively people that follow people and, you know, the referenceability. And well, if that one's doing it, then it must be right. That's if you trust them. And I, you know, we've always said we're in the trust business. So again, if somebody trusts somebody, they're going to go, okay, what did Paul do? Oh, Paul did that. Well, then it must be okay. And we get that. We understand that because it comes back to risk. But I think one of the things that we're starting to find is we need to understand so much of the organization. But the organization doesn't understand enough about itself.
Yeah.
So again, you've got to try and meet that at the best possible way, right?
And also just to touch on the resourcing aspect. I mean, a common thing that we know is lack of resources, lack of skilled resources in the market. Mm. And then you still have this increment of risk, right? And risk is the only constant. It will grow yearly. No matter what you do, no matter what you do as an organization, it will grow. So now you've got a lack of resources, increased risk, you've got decreased budgets. How do you start consolidating your efforts to actually reach a posture level that decreases risk inside the organization? And this is where AI and machine learning and generative AI can theoretically play a massive value. And we have a lot of our vendors also, you know, we have vendors that... Again, rubber stamp the word on technology search, but then we have other vendors that actually utilize the machine learning algorithm around consumption of information, take out all the noise and give you the risk elements immediately. So that as defenders or threat defenders in the organization, you actually have the tools to be proactive and not reactive. Mm. A lot in IT and with regards to compliance and governance at the moment is a very reactive process. It is, you know, looking in the mirror around what already took place and what already happened. And that doesn't help the organization. You know, valuable information, yes, great. We can change how we were hacked, okay? But that doesn't change the fact that you were hacked. So forward thinking.
Should the person looking after data governance be an IT person? Or should they come from a risk background?
I like the risk background because I've always said this, and you know, with many of the CISOs and you know risk officers that we've had the opportunity to sit with, the minute that we're sitting around a table talking about risk to the organization, we're going to spend less because we understand our business. We're going to put the right processes, right people in, and I think taking that risk-based approach is really, really critical because it means that you understand your business, you understand your consumer, you understand the end goal. Yeah. What I have found in the past is that risk is told to sit over there because the IT guys have got it. and in fact, I've been very fortunate to work with some CISOs where they've made it very clear to the business, you want me to go and do paperwork? I'm not your guy. Mm-hmm. Get yourself a risk officer and governance officer, and if you want me to, I will defend the organization. So I think, you know, that's a really practical approach. And I'll tell you what, that organization today has consolidated its technology stack. It's always looking at innovation, but it's built its foundations. It's got user behavior analytics built at the heart of it. It's understanding its insider use of its data. Mm-hmm. I'm sure they've got their own challenges. And then they've got the governance aspect, which is really where those two key or three key people get together. It's about practically how do we then appease auditor as well as, you know, defend the organization. And I think, again, for me, it's, you know, your CISO today. I mean, we've all seen that spider graph, right? The CISO started out with, you know, two core job roles, and then all of a sudden became 54 core job roles. And that's everything from privacy officer to information protector to defender of evil. Mm-hmm. They don't have the bandwidth. Also, never mind that, they don't have the cultural and political clout in the organization of where they sit. And that always, I mean, you guys have done a number of articles on this, is where is the CISO's role actually meant to report to? Mm-hmm. And that's a huge challenge. And by the way, when you engage with organizations, you can see, you know, is our data officer, is our CISO, are they political? deployments, or are they there to infect change? Mm-hmm. You can feel that straight away with any guy.
Yeah.
You know, if we're going to dance around bringing everybody on the journey, I get that. But if we're going to make change, you know what? Then we're going to influence and change the way the organization behaves.
Yeah.
Christian, describe a company that's doing this optimally, doing it well. What does it actually look like?
So, I mean, one of the biggest risks that we see organizations trying to tackle at the moment is on the consumer space. So customers, mm-hmm. Specifically banking and telco sectors. And one of the best things that we've seen in the market in quite some time has been, how do you do identity verification? But not verification at the point of enrollment, verification in a continuous base. So we've been having some very mature conversations with our customers around, how do we add to their risk? Well, how do we decrease their risk by adding in telemetrics from authentication attempts, telemetrics from the actual devices, how these consumers are actually consuming information, but then taking that information and speaking to the fraud divisions, the fraud and the risk officers, and getting that view on what is the organizational's risk and fraud levels look like, mm-hmm. and how we can actually assist in decreasing that by elevating the verification and onboarding perspective from what we term as KYC, to know your customer. This is a metric that how easily you can be onboarded as a consumer into a specific brand or into a specific organization. What's the ease of use? And then also, how is your security actually protected? So we find that by increasing verification and verification of information, a lot of those organizations can then decrease their actual fraud aspects, mm-hmm. which, immensely opens up budgets throughout the rest of the organization. There's a real tangible benefit to it, because there's always acceptable risk and acceptable fraud in any of the large organizations that we deal with. So, I obviously don't want to paint with broad strokes here, but some of the organizations that are actually embarking on that journey, or at least deploying that from a methodology perspective, are seeing greater returns from their investments mm-hmm. than others. I mean, there is no singular point solution. It's like the zero trust conversation. Again, you can't throw a product at zero trust. You can't throw a singular product, at least at CASB or something like that. Mm-hmm. It's terminology. It's standards. It's processes around how you actually deploy and how you utilize. So yes, it can increase your posturing. You can't solve identity and data with one singular vendor. I mean, there's a couple that say you can. We believe that looking at it contextually, looking at how you can actually leverage off of these generative and ML models around decreasing your time spent to find these threat actors. I mean, that's something that we live and breathe on a daily basis. Mm-hmm.
I think also, Duncan, going through this little journey that we've gone through, we found some local providers, which has been such a breath of fresh air. You know, we're not relying on Israel, China, or America, or the UK for that matter. We've actually got some local providers. In fact, we were on a call with one of them the other day and said, don't look at us as a product. Look at us as a toolbox. Mm-hmm. We're here to integrate with your organization, figure out what journey you've gone on, and then add our additional module. And believe it or not, that technology was born in one of our banks under their investor portfolio. And it's actually such a breath of fresh air not to be under that constant American pressure for the dollar or the constant Israeli pressure to get the next customer. And also, I mean, the geopolitical environment at the moment of IT. Believe it or not, you know, we'd like to think that it's not affecting us, but we've had two or three scenarios where, you know, this whole thing happening in Gaza, mm-hmm. we've had to look at this very quickly and go, oh, hold on, is this the vendor that we should be working with? It's been quite interesting. So, you know, I think the last 6 months, you know, of looking at that customer maturity, working with customers, also looking at our vendors, you know, who do we take to the client that actually addresses the problem, but most importantly helps the client with their journey and making helping them mature better. That's been so critical too.
Yeah.
Maybe we could look a little bit at ML and AI, which we've touched on throughout this conversation. Sure. But I think a lot has been written about the potential impact of generative AI, specifically around helping attackers, threat actors, do what they do. But you've also suggested that machine learning could play a very important role in help protecting organizations' data as well. So there's two sides to this coin. It's both going to help companies, but it's also going to make the situation worse in some respects.
For me, it reminds me of that conversation that we used to have around open source and closed source technologies, right? You know, there is a community out there that goes, open source, freaking amazing. Mm-hmm. I can do whatever I want with it. I can add to it. I can play with it. I can change it. I can, because that's what a propeller head does, right? Yeah, yeah. And that's cool. And then there's the closed source that goes, listen, actually, I'd rather have something that's adopted by many people. It's trustworthy. It does what it says it does on the box, and I get a better return on investment. I know it costs me a dollar more than open source. And for me, this is the conversation with, especially when we start talking about data, right? We're talking about ultimately where we think AI is coming in and the machine learning models. It's all about the amount of data that we have access to in an organization and what you do with it or your technology does with it. Now, there are a lot of articles, and I appreciate everybody's opinion, but the reality is in our world, from a cyber perspective, it's quite simple, right? We have open AI, which is very simply everybody in a community contributing to algorithms and build and open source, right? Yep. And then we have the MITRE ATT&CK framework. So, you know, what I would strongly suggest with customers is that they understand when they're working with solution providers and with the technologies of choice they're going with, they've got to understand very quickly before they have an opinion is what is community driven, where algorithms are changed and ethics are changed and how data is consumed and where it goes and where it lives and is it in this, this part of the world or that part of the world. Before they do that, they understand, is it open or closed? Because in a closed world, which for me is a safe world, and I say safe world with all due respect, it's still the vendor that does the algorithm. Ultimately, we're looking at a set of behaviors that we're looking for now, but be able to consume that at speed. So what are hackers doing? Hackers are using it to create at speed. So we've got to look at consuming at speed to be able to ultimately, I mean, somebody said, I think when AI first came out, the machines are going to take over. Well, buddy, don't mean to, wake you up, but the machines have taken over a long time ago. They're just doing it a little bit faster now. So I think the practical aspect of AI and the value that it adds in cyber is, again, like with the zero trust, we have the MITRE ATT&CK framework. Look at those vendors that are utilizing the MITRE ATT&CK framework and their algorithms are written around that because it's a set bunch of rules as to how organizations can be breached, data can be exfiltrated, people can be manipulated, systems can be manipulated. That is a trustworthy sense of AI. The difference is you're going to do it at speed. Mm-hmm. You're going to be able to invest, operationalize, but most importantly, answer the question quicker, better than anybody else. What do I need to do about that event? Have I been compromised? The open AI conversation, that's a different one, man. You can take ethics and where your data lives and how it lives and where it gets consumed and who uses it. That's a different conversation. But from a cyber perspective, we know what good looks like and we know what bad looks like. Customers just need to make the right decision as to the tooling they look at, what kind of BI models they look at, and focus on the closed because we know how the bad actor works. Mm-hmm. And if we're doing that, I believe we're going to achieve a lot more. But AI as a whole, I think, is phenomenal. But then there's that open world, and that open world is where opinion and the bad stuff potentially can seep in, and then ethics and all kinds of legislation needs to come in, and you can figure that out, guys. But in our world, we know what bad looks like, and that's what we've got to help our customers with. And when we look at AI models and we look at organizations that can help us do this more effectively with our customers, we're not writing our own algorithm, right? We're leveraging off algorithms that are built around specifics. And we do trust those, and we have to trust those. But the reality is we also report on it. So when we're reporting on a very key set of data, doing a very key set amount, but you're doing it at speed. Mm-hmm. And that for me is where AI really, really plays the part, and that machine modeling.
We're finding also that, focusing on this, MITRE framework, MITRE framework is built out of CVEs, right? It's known vulnerabilities that are published by research centers. So in theory, if we break that down, it's a vulnerability that has already taken place, mm-hmm. and someone wrote a white paper on it. Okay, so it's a known vulnerability. So immediately fix your known vulnerabilities. One of the fun things that we're seeing now in the market, especially from our vendors, is that they're looking at this machine learning model, okay, which is your AI model that they're kind of building, mm-hmm. and then you've got the open AI, which is your generative models, etc., and community led. There is some synergy where some of our vendors are actually pulling in some contextual data to try and pull and visualize, is the actual event a risk event, even though it might not be connected towards a known CVE?
Mm-hmm.
It could be a theoretical CVE. So we're seeing some interesting developments where that information, at least at speed, can be utilized for the benefit of, you know, expanding your known risk vectors.
And a lot of this, is, it sounds like, is going to be automated in the future without humans having to even know about it.
Well, that's the best thing, right? Mm-hmm. You know, one of the traditional things that we see in IT is security operation centers and, you know, the conversations around SIEMs and SOAR systems. A lot of that is reactive. It's reactive. It's gathering information and insight after the fact. It's typically built on static rule sets that if the rule sets are violated, you know, an alert goes off for an investigator to go and investigate. What we can utilize these types of modeling from an AI perspective for is to automatically, from a high degree of percentage certainty, figure out that an attack is in place and actually stop the attacker while the attack is happening, not after the fact.
And I think also what that helps customers achieve, and this is where that whole skills thing, there was that age-old meme that basically showed, you know, in order to become a CISO, it's 22 years in the industry and it's 1,000 certifications and eventually you're at your CISM or CISSP and, you know, you work 24 jobs and eventually you get to the CISO only to be hacked by a guy that just left school. In fact, he's probably still in school, took him 25 minutes on Google, put together a piece of code and broke into your organization, right? And it's a funny meme, but I think it really speaks true for what we're able to achieve now. You know, as consumers of highly skilled individuals, we often have to look at better ways to do it. And something like AI will help us achieve that better for our clients because we can make better decisions with the right data where the algorithm is written in order to map against what we need, as opposed to having a 200K resource looking at screens, analyzing code, and then coming back to us and saying, you won't believe what I found. Which is great, and we love that, right? That enthusiasm is always awesome. But really, I mean, in a billion lines of code, you found one small thing. Whereas with AI, we can interrogate 50 billion lines of code and have an answer very, very quickly.
Yes.
And I think there comes a point, however, we've always spoken about this for the last bunch of years, is you have to verify and you have to validate. So now we can use our 200K resources across more customers, giving us better return of investment and our customers, again, even if they're employing the 200K resources, and we know that they all do. But now he's not spending time trawling through data. He's effectively verifying and validating that what he was presented with was either right or wrong, and most importantly, what the organization now needs to do.
Mm-hmm.
And again, why would you not embrace that? Because we led in a world of code. You know, now we're just saying, let's utilize Duncan in his best capacity and the best, but I don't need him looking at screens trying to figure out whether or not that looks bad because it's already been determined it's bad. Go and verify and validate. And I think that's where humans really, really play an important part. There's that whole concept of, you know, effectively, you know, machines can't replace us because they don't have creativity and the level of logic can be taught, but there's still emotion. And I think the reality is all of that comes into play.
Mm-hmm.
When you start looking at data, you start understanding the organization. Well, that doesn't move correctly. It's telling me that, well, you know, let me go and just quickly verify. And that's where, you know, again, we'll have specialized resourcing. We won't necessarily have resourcing we're trying to put through a 12-year program in order to become specialized. We can now start with a specific baseline and we can achieve our target quicker. You know, that for me, that makes sense, right? Because everybody wins.
Yeah. Just lastly, Christian, the world is clearly moving very quickly here. We spoke at the beginning of the conversation about papaya, there's Europe's GDPR as well. How useful is this regulation in a world that is moving this rapidly? Is it actually keeping pace? Do we need to rewrite papaya already?
No. I don't think the conversations around rewriting legislation or compliance.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, applying it in the organization correctively and our ability to prosecute at infractions being detected. But the context here is we now have papaya and everyone's talking about papaya.
Mm-hmm.
If we look at our cybersecurity legislations in the past 10 years, you know, it's been a bit of a pattern where we see first world countries deploying and adopting, and then we see South Africa trailing along 2-3 years down the line. So if we think about a bit of a more proactive approach to how do we solve problems and how do we look towards the future and not constantly reactively looking in that blind mirror, in that rearview mirror. We see that in the US and EMEA, in the APAC region and South America, there's a lot of planned legislation around data privacy. Not only identity privacy, which is more GDPR and PIRPAIA, but the actual data components to it. So the risk of information, the risk of that information being shared, obviously also, you know, expansion of PCI compliance here across the world.
Right.
But if we take that into context and we realize that in the next 2-3 years South Africa might have something on the cards, we need to think about contextualizing our data in terms of our identities, who's accessing the information, our data types, you know, is it informational data that uses is for use by telemetry systems, and how we can consolidate all of this data into providing an actual business function, mm-hmm. and increasing security and increasing business process? Is it around the data that's sitting in our operations divisions with all of our OT devices? It's about classifying that, validating access, and then providing sure-footed mechanisms to try and determine where the behavior patterns are, you know, anomalous.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where that anomaly is, where can we see it? How quickly can we react to it? I think it all just kind of fits into one massive story where we know the legislation is coming. We know it's going to be data focused, and we still have PIRPAIA and GDPR to fix, and, you know, Californian Protection Act to adhere to if we consume any of those types of data sets, citizen data at least. We need to adhere to it. Next, more is coming. The risk is increasing on a daily basis. You need to use a set of tools and metrics to try and solve for.
Look, I think for me, when it comes to governance, in the space that we're playing, I'm very fortunate and to be on a group with some privacy officers. Mm-hmm. And like with us in IT and in cyber, we have our own acronyms, and I often get lost in their opinions. Because when it comes to privacy, it's the translation of the regulation, legislation, and how they help companies deal with this. What I enjoy most, I think, in this privacy space is the oversight.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I've seen lacking is oversight into many of our cybersecurity divisions. You know, we often get quite frustrated with working with specific individuals because they have an opinion. Where we work very well with organizations is when they have oversight, because I think when it comes to data and it comes to cyber, there are methodologies. They're clear, they're easy to follow, they're easy to tick box. In fact, there are a number of tick boxes. There's SANS, 20, what, top critical 20, you know, measures. There's a methodology to this, but it's when the cowboys come out and the cowgirls come out and everybody's doing what they think is best for their organization versus there's a methodology to this. And that's why, again, for me, I think the oversight, the governance, the risk-led approach, it gets rid of opinion, because I appreciate opinion. It gets rid of opinion, and it basically says, you know, we always talk about the metrics and the measurement to an organization. How do I know I'm secure? Well, I'm spending R1 billion on tech. Well, no, that's not. It means that ultimately, you know, you can showcase that you've depleted the risk into the organization through visible metrics, right? That, for me, is key. It's always a space we need to get to. So the governance, regardless of whether it's data, cyber, insider threat, fraud, you know, those metrics at a dashboarding level for an organization are so, so critical, because when somebody needs to save money, you know, it becomes a risk conversation,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think, again, the oversight in that is so, so crucial to ensure that your program is successful.
Yeah.
Regardless.
Well, I think we could continue this conversation all day, but we need to draw a line in the sand at some point. Jason, if anyone wants to continue the conversation with CyberOne Solutions, what's the best way of reaching the company?
Yeah, best way is obviously via the internet, and Google works spectacularly well, or Bing. I've heard that that's a thing. C1-S.com.
Okay.
You can get hold of us anytime. Quite easy to navigate. We've got a nice contact page, and that goes to all of our offices from the UK all the way through down to South Africa.
Fantastic. Well, Jason O'Reilly is MD of CyberOne Solutions. And let me get your title right, Christian. You are Senior Cybersecurity Architect, Christian Swanepoel, CyberOne Solutions. Thank you so much for sharing your insights with TechCentral today. Much appreciated.
Thanks, Duncan.
Thanks, Duncan.